This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you, Sabrina, for the news. My name is Rich Bradbury. This, of course, is Enterprise Biz Bytes. I'm joined in the studio by
Arvind Yuvraj
and Audrey Raj.
With you, as usual, all the way through until 1 p.m. this afternoon. And, of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, 018-789-8899 or on Twitter at BFM Radio. Big day today, 8th of May, 2018. Nothing else special lined up, is there? Anyway, stories lined up today regarding big days. The first story that we're looking at is something that was published not too long ago, or rather it's something that's been circulating for a while. It's about how this election is shaping up to be a WhatsApp election almost.
Yes.
We're going to have a bit of a discussion about that. We'd like your guys' input at home, please. Story number two, how Nestle will be paying $7.2 billion to sell coffee at Starbucks, or with the Starbucks.
With Starbucks, yeah.
With Starbucks, okay. And then there's an interesting story that I'm quite kind of keen to discuss as well. Why trying to measure performance at work backfires. Interesting story there. Story number four, your hotel room's electronic door can be hacked and has been hacked in the past. Finally, how sometimes when you are starting a new business and you have all of the things in place, you've got a pain point that has been covered, you've got a great idea, and how it can in fact fail, not due to your own or your company's fault. So let's start off with this WhatsApp election story then. Bit of a discussion going on, right?
Yeah, so we know how the internet and social media has helped us consume political news and views in the past few general elections. I mean, in 2008, it was all about the blogs. And in the elections in 2013, GE13, it was Facebook. And this GE14, WhatsApp is taking center stage in the coming poll. So how do we know this? Well, a little background here for you first. Well, according to an article in The Star that was published sometime in April, citing Barisan Nasional's social media experts, this election has seen both sides of the divide really pour resources into social media. Both sides have armed themselves with keyboard warriors, and parties are using social media application programming interfaces, or APIs, that can plug into platforms like Facebook and Twitter to gauge public sentiment on any particular topic. So just say a topic like Malaysian traffic or housing.
It's surprisingly quiet today, actually, here.
So, and this is well-used resources because according to the Malaysian Communications and Multimedia Commission, MCMC, there are about 24.5 million internet users in Malaysia, which accounts for a near 77% of the population. So it seems like the right thing to do, the best way to go in order to reach as many people as possible, right? And to track sentiments, they will look at public APIs because everyone has Facebook or a Twitter account. More than 60% of the population actually uses Facebook. So recent studies, even from the Australian National University, apparently shows that UMNO now has greater traction on social media and stronger online presence as a whole compared with the opposition. Because we know in 2008 and 2013, the opposition seemed to have an upper hand when it came to spreading political news and views via social media and just basically online via blogs. And you know what's more popular than Facebook and Twitter today in this election? It is WhatsApp. So the Digital News Report 2017 by Reuters said that 51% of news consumers in Malaysia use WhatsApp to find, share and discuss news in a given week. The study also indicated that Malaysia is the global leader for WhatsApp in terms of news consumption.
Really?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
And the problem is, you know, and like I said earlier, that parties can actually gauge what you're viewing on Facebook, what you're checking out on Twitter using APIs, right? You can't use APIs for WhatsApp because communication is encrypted. So in other words, even if, you know, parties had access to WhatsApp, they can't gauge sentiment from the public. So they really don't know what people are sharing and how they're feeling about things and what they're discussing on WhatsApp. But that's how everyone is apparently doing it this elections.
Okay, a quick poll here in the studio. How many of you are part of an election group on WhatsApp?
But with election-based content?
Yeah.
I am. I have four different groups, you know, family, friends, previous colleagues, college mates, in fact, that all have, basically our group has become everyone's just sharing election-based content.
Of?
Yeah, same.
Same.
At least two.
Yeah.
At least two. But then the unofficial ones are like, you know, your family groups, your friend groups. That's when you get some news. And then if anything pops up, I actually get alerts and news news alerts on WhatsApp faster than I do on like my other app alerts. Like before the Star pings me with something or any other news portal pings me with some kind of news, I'll see like a WhatsApp message about it. That's how quick it is.
And the news in those groups that you receive, does it tend to be fairly balanced or is it slightly one-sided, would you say? I mean, just, you know, for argument's sake.
You know, in the show that just aired before this, I spoke to Jan Wong and Daryl Tan from Open Minds Resources. They said that the problem with, consuming political news via social media and online, the problem is that you're basically only going to receive news in your own bubble.
Mm.
The way you sway is the kind of news that you would be inclined to read, inclined to share, inclined to post. So that's the kind of bubble that you're going to remain in. So you're not actually getting a balanced view. You're just getting articles that you want to see.
Mm.
Yeah, because they're like-minded people and the people that you share your opinions with. And then if you know that the news is coming from a group that you don't share your opinions with, then more often than not, you're going to sort of ignore a chunk of the content from there, and then you're going to look at the groups that you sort of, you know, gravitate to and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it's... Sorry, Ode, go on.
And you can't really blame an algorithm for something like this that happens, say, on Facebook. You know, if you want to say that your news feed is curated to show you what you want to see, this is not exactly the case when it comes to WhatsApp, because people are just sharing what they want to share. And it's what you consume that kind of, like, puts you in that bubble.
I mean, we've heard of... you know, the kind of auntie and uncle WhatsApp groups that we're all part of, you know, and we end up with reading pieces of news in there that are not necessarily accurate.
Yes.
So that kind of begs the question of, you know, people that are in these groups and they're sharing this content. And like you say, we're on the top of the world with the amount of people who use Facebook.
Global leaders globally. When it comes to news consumption.
That's so surprising. I mean, so it is important. It's an important medium, you know. So how important is it that we double check those sources that we read?
But that's the thing. I mean, it's one thing for you to double check, but if you're talking about the new anti-fake news law, how are they going to really enforce that? They're really going to have to look back at who started sharing the false news to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. That's the person that they have to charge. But how far back does that go? And how do you trace that person who started the rumor or started sharing that article? It's a tough one.
Mm.
But what I think what this BN social media expert actually said was that in order to, because they understand that this is a WhatsApp election, it's an encrypted election, they feel the best thing that they can do is make media that's perfect for WhatsApp. So that means compressed videos and pictures that can be easily forwarded around. But the challenge still remains. They don't know how to gauge that WhatsApp reach. And what people are discussing the sentiment.
Interesting.
Yeah, surprisingly, most of the stuff, the messages that I've got in over the last few weeks have not been so much one-sided for one or the other. It's just basically about telling people what is the proper way to vote, telling people the proper way to dress when you go to vote, how to mark your ballot papers, and just encouraging people to go out and do something. So it's a lot of those hashtags like Pulang Undi and stuff like that. You know, don't waste your opportunity to vote, which is surprisingly a lot more than, you know, them taking a stand for one or the other. So I found that a bit surprising this time around.
Interesting.
And I cannot count how many times I've received the SPR
link.
Yes, the SPR link for you to check if you're a registered voter, and people just reminding you constantly to print out your information, your details, your saluran, so that when you reach your polling center in the morning, you're not faced with any difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to ask a question to the people at home then?
Yes, we do. We want to know the kind of, are you receiving election-based content via WhatsApp? More, have you seen more WhatsApp?
Videos, messages,
articles and links. Are you consuming it more on WhatsApp than you are on any other kind of platform?
Yeah. I mean, this is something we're going to be discussing throughout the show as well. Some of the videos that we've come across as well, whether or not they be advertisements before a YouTube video or if they're videos shared by local celebrities or anything like that. We're going to be having a bit of a chat about that too. Let us know what the rate of WhatsApp messages you are getting. Related to election-based coverage, let us know on WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Or, of course, you can get us on Twitter as well, at BFM Radio. Moving on to story number two, coffee. Yeah. Please keep me awake, Arvin. You know,
yeah,
I don't know if I'm done with election news yet, but you know, I'm feeling a little bit.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So speaking about two people trying to get the crowd on their side. So Nescafe and Nestle and Starbucks used to be rivals, but now they are working together to upgrade their coffee empires. So basically, Nescafe will pay Starbucks $7.15 billion upfront in cash for the rights to sell Starbucks coffee products in supermarkets, in restaurants, in catering operations, and Nestle will also use the Starbucks brand in its Nespresso and Dolce Gusto capsule systems this year. So you know those capsules that you buy for the machine? Yeah. So those might have Starbucks flavors and the Starbucks logo itself.
Made by Nestle.
They haven't said, so that's the one thing they haven't said. They said that they will take over manufacturing, but they haven't said what ingredients that they will use. That's the one detail that's not in this article at all, and I can't find it anywhere. So why are Nestle doing this? It's because they've always wanted to capture a more upscale Java market in the US, which is why they launched an Nespresso. If you look at the advertisements, it has these high profile celebrities like George Clooney is there. It's all very
upmarket. He was the big name behind it, wasn't he?
Yeah. So it's all very upmarket for the Nespresso, whereas the Dolce Gusto is more hipster, more artisan, that kind of thing.
It's funny you say that, because even back in the UK, and I'm talking almost 20 years ago, there were Nescafe Gold Blend adverts, and they were all done by very high profile, very posh celebrities. You know, the normal coffee, the normal jars of instant coffee, just normal everyday people advertising it. But of course, the Nescafe Gold Blend brand was done entirely different, and you could see right through the advertising mire, you know.
Yeah, so they've always tried, for like you said, for decades they've been trying to get to that upscale, the upmarket coffee drinkers and stuff, but they haven't been able to, because in the US they've always been outpaced by JAB Holdings company, and they have backing of about $30 billion from the Raymond family in Europe, which allowed them to buy brands like Keurig Green Mountain and Peet's and stuff like that. So they captured the more upscale market for coffee drinkers. So what Nescafe did, I mean what Nestle did, is they've teamed up with Starbucks, and now both of them will try to capture that market instead and keep JAB at sort of like a distance. What this means for coffee consumers is that Starbucks will continue to produce the coffee products in North America, while Nestle will be in charge of manufacturing in the rest of the world. So what I think that means is only in the US or North America, Starbucks will still be using the ingredients and stuff, whereas in the rest of the world, Nestle will take over for ingredients and manufacturing and stuff.
No.
That's what I understand.
Oh, Rich, what will you do every morning?
Well, I mean, it's only today that I've recently gone to the mermaid shop, you know, Starbucks. Normally, I get my coffee from somewhere else, which is considerably cheaper and for a larger amount. But I don't know. I mean, this kind of gives me, you know, makes me pause a little bit and think about this. And the I do use Nestle on a daily basis, and I know I'm not the only one, Audrey, giving me the whole, you know, because we use a 3-in-1 kind of packets whilst we're here in the office, you know, just kind of keep us going through the day. I don't know, though. I mean, it's not that I'm saying Nestle and Nescafe are a lesser brand, but I think for a lot of people, they're going to think that, aren't they? You know, and even tying in with Starbucks, I don't think will change opinion that much.
Yeah, I actually don't know why Nestle, I mean, this is just me, why Nestle's been trying to capture like a complete different market, because they are so mainstream. They're like Milo.
Right, yeah.
When you go to like Mama and you order for coffee, more often than not, it's a Nescafe. You order
Indeed.
For Nescafe. And when
Indeed.
You, it's like, here in Malaysia, it's like when you say hot chocolate, it's Milo. It's
right.
like synonymous. There's no difference, right? So I don't know why, but I guess, you know, it's a business strategy thing, and they need to sort of leverage on Starbucks to climb to certain brackets that they haven't reached yet and stuff. They will also book sales for Starbucks. They'll also pay royalties to Starbucks. About 500 Starbucks employees in the US will join Nestle, and operations will continue to be located in Seattle, so no changes there. And this agreement is expected to close by the end of 2018. So from next year onwards, we'll see if there are any changes for our part of the world, I guess.
Interesting stuff. Yep. Right, we're going to take a very short break then. When we come back, our story about why trying to measure performance at work often backfires. Meanwhile, don't forget, we started off with a question about how it's shaped up to be a bit of a WhatsApp election, people receiving content, election-based content via WhatsApp WhatsApp group and messages. Let us know if you've had some of those and what kind of content it is. Please keep it, you know, PG, and let us know. 018-789-8899, or of course, on Twitter, at BFM Radio. Time for some music. It's a bit of Eric Clapton, Gotta Get Over, here on BFM 89.9.
Because feelings matter. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes here on BFM 89.9. I'm Rich Bradbury in the studio with
Arvind Yuvraj
and Audrey Raj.
Started off with a story about how Malaysia is, the forthcoming elections are shaping up to be a WhatsApp election. Arvind was mentioning a few things in some of the groups that he is part of, where it was stuff about information you need to know when you are going to the ballot box. And Audrey was telling me about things like printing off your information. Your voter details. So the question that we want to ask you guys then is, you know, do you feel better informed about the election because of some of the information that you're receiving in the WhatsApp messages? Let us know. 018-789-8899 or get us on Twitter at BFM Radio Odds.
Yeah, so we've got a couple of messages here. Nikki Cheong says, a lot of people are dubbing GE14 as the WhatsApp election. My reading is that the elections this time is mostly mediated through video.
Interesting.
Good point, right? Then you've got Carrie that says, the Rakyat will be watching you, SPR. We have WhatsApp and other social media platforms today that will be used to disseminate any misdeeds real time. Be careful. The masses will be watching.
Ooh. Ooh.
Okay, and then there's another one from Hafiz Azari. He says, there are so many fitnah from social media, WhatsApp group, etc. Sudahlah tu. Such things should have no part in a democratic process.
Interesting stuff. Let us know. Keep the messages coming. 018-789-8899 or on Twitter at BFM Radio. This is a discussion that, you know, a lot of people have around the coffee shops and one thing or another, especially if they're working for a public listed company or anything like that, how trying to measure performance at work often backfires. And this is an interesting piece, and it's from a book called The Tyranny of Metrics, by Jerry Muller. He's a professor of history at the University of America in Washington, D.C. And he says, measuring people makes them focus on gaming the metrics for themselves, not long-term goals of the organization. So here we go. So he says the rewards can be monetary in the form of pay for performance, say, or reputational in the form of college rankings, hospital ratings, surgical report cards, and so on. But the most dramatic negative effect of metric fixation is its propensity to incentivize gaming. That is, encouraging professionals to maximize the metrics in a way that are at odds with the larger purpose of the organization. If the rate of major crimes in a district becomes the metric according to which police officers are promoted, then some officers will respond by simply not recording crimes or downgrading them from major offenses to misdemeanors. Or take the case of surgeons. When the metric of success and failure are made public, affecting their reputation and income, some surgeons will improve their metric scores by refusing to operate on patients with more complex problems. Whose surgical outcomes are more likely to be negative? Who suffers? The patients who don't get operated upon. So when reward is tied to measured performance, metric fixation invites just this sort of gaming. But metric fixation also leads to a variety of more subtle, unintended negative consequences. These include goal displacement, which comes in many varieties. When performance is judged by a few measures and the stakes are high, things like keeping one's job, getting a pay rise, or raising the stock price at the time when the stock options are vested, people focus on satisfying those measures, often at the expense of other more important organizational goals that are not measured. The best-known example of this in the US is teaching to the test, a widespread phenomenon that, of course, was part of the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They literally taught what was on the syllabus and little to nothing else. The other issue is what he refers to as short-terminism, another negative. You know, it's endemic to publicly traded corporations that sacrifice long-term research and development and the development of their staff to the perceived imperatives of the quarterly report. So, contrary to common sense belief, attempts to measure productivity through performance metrics discourage initiative, innovation, and risk-taking. So if you're in a company, like a startup company, often this is a really bad idea. So if you look at it this way, and he gives a really interesting analogy. He said, imagine the intelligence analysts who ultimately located Osama bin Laden. You know, they worked on that problem for years. And if you measured them at any point, the productivity of those analysts would have been zero.
Yeah.
Month after month, their failure rate was 100% until they achieved success. from the perspective of the superiors, allowing the analyst to work on that project for years involved a high degree of risk. The investment in time might not pan out, yet really great achievements often depend on such risks. I think this is a really, really interesting article, right?
Yeah.
And as part of, you know, not just this company, but many other companies that we've been a part of, this whole incentivized idea of being at work, you know, like almost gamifying being at work, becomes an issue, right? Do you not think so?
I totally agree, but how else would you measure performance then?
Right.
Yes.
Right?
What is the alternative?
Exactly. So one of the other things that he goes on to talk about is how the source of the trouble is that when people are judged by performance metrics, they are incentivized to do what the metrics measure, and what the metrics measure will be some established goals, right? But that impedes innovation, which means doing something not yet established, indeed that hasn't even been tried out. Innovation needs and involves experimentation. Compelling people in an organization to focus their efforts on a narrow range of measurable features degrades the experience of work. Subject to performance metrics, people are forced to focus on limited goals imposed by others who might not understand the work that they do.
Yeah.
Mental stimulation is dulled when people don't decide the problems to be solved or how to solve them, and there is no excitement of venturing into the unknown because the unknown is beyond the measurable. The entrepreneurial element of human nature is stifled because of metric fixation.
But what is the solution? He's telling us what we already know, but
right.
What is the solution?
Right, I know. But this is the whole point. I thought I'd read that and we could have a debate about that and a discussion about that. I mean, what, Arvin, for you, off the top of your head, what do you think would be another alternative to this?
Actually, when listening to you go through what he said, it looks like it works for like 50% of the situation, and then the other 50% you can't do it. Because if you work in something like, let's say, a bank, and the bank wants to reach like certain amount, like they have their quotas that they have to reach by the end of the month, then you have to measure someone based on that quota at the end of the month. Like a bank cannot have, they can have like long-term goals, like they can have like in 2 years we want to do this, we want to get rid of all what do they call it, like non-functioning loans and this, they can have like long-term goals, but short-term goals is also very important. Otherwise, you're going to get people just sitting around doing nothing, and you wouldn't be able to penalize them or tell them to like buck up and, you know, do their job because you think that they were working on like...
We know there are companies like that here.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
And elsewhere.
But
on
the flip side, even if you're in a bank and if you're only focusing on like, say, set KPIs, A through E, what about everything else that could be improved on? Like what Rich is saying, there's no innovation, there's no trying to work on things that would help improve systems, processes. You know, that should also be an important thing.
What about what Google does, their 20% thing? You know, so you have 80% of your working week is KPIs. You know, you have to hit these targets, blah, blah, blah. But for 20% of that time, you do what you want. And that kind of gives you that creativity break, that innovation break, perhaps. Maybe something like that would work.
I think that's something that works for us here. We have that whole 80-20-20% being our babies, you know, our passion projects. That's kind of worked for us as well because it's kind of, it gives us something fulfilling. But we're talking about measuring performance. I don't know.
It's difficult,
right? I don't know how you could do this any other way.
It's difficult.
I think it only works in mature companies and organizations. They have to be, because if your whole procedure of getting people to work is, you know, not letting them be creative. In some places, you just cannot be creative. It's just like, you know, it's standard, straightforward work.
Like a bank.
Yeah, like a bank. So if you, I mean, banks can come up with different styles of giving out loans and different kinds of loans.
They can get creative too.
They can. But it depends on who's doing it, I guess. So if the 80-20 work there, then I would think like, you know, most of the people who are working on this project have to finish this project by the due date. But then the other 20%, they get to figure out the bank's overall goal. So then they can work on something like that. But then managers and supervisors also have to know how to measure that. Because if you give people 20%, and they don't know how to use it and they abuse it, then the overall goal sort of slumps as well, because then no one's working towards it. Everyone's just going, I have 20%. It's like in, you know, back in school, we used to have there was a session, what is it called? Like, it wasn't PJK, it wasn't sports, it was something else like KK or something like that. And it used to be like an hour of free time. And that hour was to help students finish their homework, revise what was coming up next, and just prepare for the subject that was coming up, like math or physics or whatever. No one did it.
Of course.
Like, yeah, no one did. So they completely abused the system. Kids would stay out of class and they would come back in and not prepare for the next thing. It was known as like the free period. And the teacher who sat in also, you know, didn't bother to do anything about it. So if there's no one managing like the 20% or the free time or just like still helping people push towards their common goal, then it's still going to be a problem.
All right, we have to wrap up for this segment. We've got some music coming up from Journey with Faithfully. When we get back, one story about how your hotel room's electronic door can be hacked. Not willing to worry you, but you know, it might do a little bit. Do get back to us on the question that we asked. You know, do you feel better informed about the election thanks to all of these WhatsApp groups and messages that are circulating right now? Let us know, 018-789-8899 or on Twitter at BFM Radio. Time for some music here on BFM 89.9.
Balanced Frank Medium, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm in the studio with
Arvind Yuvaraj
and Audrey Raj.
Still with you until 1 o'clock this afternoon. We start off the show with how a story about how it's shaping up to be a WhatsApp election. The question we're asking you guys at home is, do you feel better informed about the election due to some of these messages you are receiving in your WhatsApp? Audrey, do we have anything?
Yeah, we do. I mean, most people here are, I mean, in general, are just saying that they are tired with all the forwarded messages. I think it was Helena who said that she actually received like a weird video of a particular Menteri Besar, and it was just complete spam, and she's just tired of things like this.
I've seen rapping MPs, I've seen stand-up comedians doing videos, I've seen empty mamak stalls, I've seen all kinds of stuff.
It's getting really creative this year,
right? It's very creative this time,
I've got one message. There were some messages, and this was also surprising because we also talk about how people send messages and no one cares to verify them. It's all like old news, or it's fake, you know, it's information that isn't true and stuff. There was a video that was forwarded that was made up and completely that wasn't true, and couple of people below it said, you should verify this video, this isn't true, this is an old video, please remove it. And the person who posted it actually apologized and said, I'm sorry, I got it from another group, I'll check my sources next time. So
they're becoming self-policing almost.
Yeah, self-policing is becoming healthier. People know that because of this flood of information that's coming in, that they should sort of like filter it out and then double check their sources and confirm their, you know, where it comes from and stuff.
And here's something interesting, it's not related to WhatsApp, it's actually related to Waze. So every day on my Waze home, I usually get a prompt from Nando's telling me to go visit Nando's, you know, since you're close by, why not, you know, pop into Nando's on my Waze. It's like a little advert, right?
Yeah.
But over the past week, I've just been receiving political ads.
Interesting.
On Waze too. So I found that quite interesting. I didn't realize that could be used as a platform as well. But then again, you know, it's free game.
Anything that you can get an advert on nowadays.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Moving on to our next story. Your hotel room's electronic door can be hacked.
Mm-hmm.
Arvind, why do you know, this is normally a kind of Jeff Sandu, Matt Armitage territory, you know?
Yeah,
what are you doing to us?
I don't know, I just had to.
All right.
You know, this is something that I've actually worried about like a lot in hotel rooms, especially because it just takes a card and we know how easy it is to swipe that.
Clone those cards as well.
But I didn't know how difficult and how easy at the same time it can be. There was a case of a laptop being stolen in Berlin 15 years ago. There were no traces of forced entry into the hotel room. This was in a hotel. No digital evidence of unauthorized access. So the computer security company F-Secure, they make everything from like security solutions to like webcam blockers and stuff.
Yeah.
So they were pretty interested in this case ever since. They've been trying to find out what actually happened, and they recently found out that millions of hotel rooms around the world are vulnerable to hacking. Using a weak spot in the software, researchers were able to create master keys to fit all doors in the entire building. So that's the gap they found. So F-Secure said
that's
that,
a bit of a gap.
So F-Secure said that it wanted to find out if it's possible to bypass the electronic lock without leaving a trace. Only after they thoroughly understood how it was designed were they able to identify shortcomings and come up with a method for creating master keys, which they were able to do. On the flip side, the makers of these locks, one of the most popular ones is a company called Asla Abloy. They quickly played down the risks in connection with the software's weak points. So most of these companies, they use a software called Vision Software. So that's the thing that's installed into your locks when you go to these hotels. They say that it's 20 years old. F-Secure says that 20 years old is a bit outdated, but they are saying that even though it is 20 years old, the product is 20 years old, it has been, it was only only compromised 12 years ago. It took 12 years and thousands of hours of intensive work by employees at F-Secure to find out the weak spot in the software. So they're saying that although someone did it 15 years ago in Berlin and whatever,
it's taken them this long to figure out.
Yeah. So it's not that easy to replicate one, and it's not a common problem. And they're also saying that these old locks represent only a small fraction of the ones that are still in use and are being rapidly replaced by new technology.
I mean, you're hearing this story and they're saying that this happened, what, 15 years ago?
15 years ago in Berlin, and then 12 years ago again at some conference.
What would be your first guess? Who would be your first guess?
That did this?
Yeah.
Are we surprised?
I would say, you know, possibly a software developer who works for Assa Abloy or somebody like that, you know?
Oh.
I mean, they're going to be the people that have the software and the know-how and the creativity to do something like that. Wouldn't you just think, okay, maybe we should look a little bit closer to home, perhaps?
Oh, so you're saying it's like inside. So Assa Abloy makes the locks themselves, but then they buy the software from Vision Software.
Okay, sorry, Vision Software.
Well, okay, so completely inside and stuff. So they're the only ones who know the weak spot.
It's taken us 15 years to find the employee who's done this, and, you know, that's what, I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating, of course.
I thought we already had a solution to this 15 years ago. I mean, from all my years watching TV, don't you just need a credit card to get into a hotel room? Like, you just like swipe through the side and, you know,
I have seen
it just unlocks magically.
A hanger.
I have seen somebody, no joke, break into a hotel room when they locked themselves out using a pizza flyer. That's all it took. They folded it in half a couple of times, shoved it in, boom, straight in through the door.
There you go. Your solution is a Pizza
this,
Hut.
Yeah. So was this locked by the card system, or is this like an
locked
actual
by
lock?
The card system, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, same way. So,
okay.
Not wishing to put the fear of whatever into you, but there you go. It's as easy as that, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have to take a very short break because we are running out of time. We've got another story to get through yet. Let's have some music. It is The Breeders with Cannonball here on BFM 89.9. When we come back, our final story of the day, the makers of the smart luggage, which seemed like a great idea.
Yes, it did.
Have gone bust. We'll tell you more why and why in just a few minutes. Don't forget, though, we are asking you, do you feel better informed about the election due to some of the messages you're receiving in your WhatsApp messages? Or are you at the point where you don't want to see any more of these messages? Let us know. 018-789-8899. BFM 89.9.
Building first world mindsets. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. My name is Rich Bradbury in the studio with
Arvind Yuvaraj
and Audrey Raj.
Everybody's clearly on their toes right now, right? Final story of the day. I've got to get it out in 4 minutes, right? So we talked about how, was it last week? We were speaking about how to be a good new business, you need to solve a pain point.
Yes.
There has to be a pain point. You have to find out what it is and you have to solve the issue with it, right?
It gives you a greater chance of success.
Right. So one of the pain points that I often have is being at the airport and misplacing my luggage sometimes and having to carry that luggage around with me. And one thing, you know, I've often left it in a restaurant and I've wandered off. Mm. I'm tired. You know, I shouldn't do that. I know it causes a whole bunch of problems. But there's a smart luggage company and they are called BlueSmart, and they started back in 2014 with more than $2 million from a crowdfunding campaign. Now, what they did was something quite smart. It's a bag that's powered by batteries. It includes GPS connectivity that lets you track wherever they are if you have a cell phone reception. It includes a charger for digital devices, a scale to weigh the bag, an auto-locking mechanism, and it can even follow you around, right? So if you're wandering around, this thing will follow you. It's a very cool idea. Mm-hmm. But then what happened? The airlines banned lithium batteries, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Oh.
So this company had a really smart idea. I mean, don't get me wrong. These things are probably more expensive than we'd want to pay for a piece of luggage.
Yeah, but if you watch the video, you know you want one. And you know this is just ideal for anyone who travels.
Correct.
And, you know, just not having to lug your bag around with you. Your bag just follows
It follows you,
you
around. Mm. It's like a mini Iron Man following you. Iron Man? No. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Following you around. You know, it's got the lights on it. You just it would just be so cool. And it's something that you could imagine in the future, you know, in like one of these very swanky airports. This bag following you around, it'd be very cool. Sadly, though, they've gone bust because the airlines have banned these lithium batteries. But it just goes to show you that even if you have a great idea, and even if you have the funding, and even if you've solved that pain point, your business could fail due to no fault of your own.
It's like the universe is conspiring against you.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so sad.
Right, we have to wrap up. But before we do, do we have any more messages to take us out of the show?
Yes. Yeah, so our top story was about how GE14 is shaping up to be a WhatsApp election. William chimed in to say he used WhatsApp recently to get Malaysian diaspora living in his city to pass their overseas ballot papers to carry their votes back to Malaysia.
Well done.
Passed on to respective families, friends and runners back to their respective constituencies. William, thank you very much. He's actually based in Adelaide, but he's back in KL today to vote.
Well done, William. Mm-hmm. Right, it's time for us to wrap up, of course. We'll quickly run through the stories in case you missed any part of the show. Don't forget, if you did, you can download the BFM app from the Apple App Store or from Google Play and listen back at your leisure. So we did start off with that WhatsApp story then.
Yes, and how G14 is shaping up to be a WhatsApp election.
We also spoke about how Nestle is paying $7.2 billion to sell coffee at Starbucks. No, with Starbucks branding.
Yep. Then we moved on to why trying to measure performance at work can backfire.
Then we spoke about how your hotel room's electronic door can be hacked.
And then finally, how the makers of the smart luggage, one of them has actually gone bust. Boo. Anyway, but don't go anywhere, of course, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, it is the Breakfast Grill replay. The National Patriot Association, Patriot, was established in May 2017 as a non-partisan group of veteran members of the armed forces and police. The Breakfast Grill spoke to the founding president of Patriot, that is Brigadier General Dato Arshad Raji, on the organization's mission and their aspirations. That's all coming up after the 1 o'clock news. Right, that's all the time we have for today then. My name is Rich Bradbury. On behalf of Arvind Yuvaraj and, of course, Audrey Raj, we will be back tomorrow. I will be back on air tomorrow at 10 a.m. Helping you guys through the election day coverage. There you go. It is BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.